You're listening to a message from Oaks Church Brooklyn. Our longing is to see heaven come to earth in our city. For more information on our church and community, please visit oaksbk.church.
Today's teaching text is a paraphrase from Exodus 2, 11 through 7, 13. Labeled a murderer, a young prince wanders the wasteland. Here, he finds a new start, a new family, and a son to call his own. This would-be redeemer is now a humble shepherd, and the plight of his people is a distant memory. But God hasn't forgotten his people, and this lost son will soon be called into service. On the mountain of God, Moses meets his maker, and despite his protests, he becomes the redeemer he was always destined to be. This is the story of God.
We are in the Exodus story, the Exodus narrative, you know, if you grew up in the 90s or the 2000s, the Prince of Egypt, that story, that one, that seminal story that comes right after Genesis. It's this encapsulating story that kind of summarizes the entire history of the Hebrew people. Matter of fact, this story that we're in, the Exodus story, is the most important story, I would argue, in the Old Testament. It's the story around which the entire identity of the people of Israel is rooted. Matter of fact, if you continue to read your Old Testament, Yahweh would often give the people of Israel these moral injunctions, these things to do, these ways to represent him in the world. And then he would tell them, do this or remember this or say this because you were once enslaved in Egypt. And matter of fact, when Yahweh identifies himself, God, the God of Israel, identifies himself, he often identifies himself as the one who rescued you from Egypt. So this story we are in is seminal to the people of Israel. And so it makes sense then, in this story that kind of frames the identity of the Hebrew people, finds its kind of axis, its center point in this character Moses. In many ways, as we'll tell Moses' story today, Moses can be seen as the typological Israelite. Moses' story reflects Israel's story. And so where we last left Moses, Moses had committed murder. He saw an injustice. He saw an Egyptian slave driver accosting an enslaved Israelite. And so he does what he only knows how to do. He attacks the Egyptian, kills him. But his secret doesn't stay a secret for long. The murder he tries to cover up, this kind of act of justice he tries to take for himself, gets exposed. And it gets exposed not by the Egyptians, but by a fellow Hebrew, who when Moses tries to break up a quarrel between these two enslaved Hebrews, they tell him, "Who are you? Who made you prince over us? Who gave you authority?" And the question's a fair one, because Moses is too Hebrew for the Egyptians and too Egyptians for the Hebrews. And really, though he sits in the royal court of Pharaoh, he has no authority. Who is he to come into a situation and try to make peace between his brothers if he has no authority to do so? Moses the Egyptian, Moses the Hebrew, Moses the Redeemer, Moses the murderer, a man seemingly at odds with himself. And it's this tension. Who is Moses? Who will he be? Is he an Egyptian or is he a Hebrew? Is he a murderer or is he a redeemer? Who is he that becomes so central to this narrative? Because the question we then ask is, what is or who is the people of Israel. And so as a result of his murder coming to light, fearing the justice of Pharaoh, Moses flees to Midian. And it's in Midian that Moses puts his past behind him. You see, he does what you do. Moses kind of having this innate sense of justice, sees these women trying to get water for their sheep, and these shepherds come and kind of drive them away. But Moses, being a person who can't stand injustice, makes sure these women can get their water. And they go back to their father saying, hey, listen, there's this Egyptian guy out here helping us get water. He didn't have to do this. And then their father says, well, you found a man like this. You didn't invite him to dinner? And so he gets invited to dinner, and pretty soon Moses finds a wife. And Moses has a son. And it's interesting what he names his son. He names his son Gershom, which means I have been a stranger in a foreign land. This name is interesting because it finally puts language to the conflict of identity happening within Moses. Like Israel, Moses has become a stranger in a foreign land. And it's now this act of self-identification with the plight of his people that Moses actually begins to take the shape of a redeemer. Because before, Moses was Hebrew, but he was in the halls of power. But now he thoroughly feels the plight of his people. His people are sojourners, strangers, aliens in a foreign land. And so now Moses also finds himself a stranger in a foreign land. And it's this self-identification that seems preparatory for who he will be. With stripped of the trappings of Egypt and empire, Moses now can truly identify with his people. Who is Moses? He's always been a stranger in a foreign land. Now he's just tasting it differently. Yet despite this self-identification, despite this apparent, you see in the Moses story, his need for justice, the fiery liberator who went out of his way to commit murder to try to free someone puts his past behind them, and Moses becomes a shepherd. And so now our story shifts. Now Moses, now in Midian with a wife and a son and a new occupation, it seems like he goes about his life. But while Moses has moved past his past, Yahweh has not. And so we see the shift in the story from this particular to the cosmic, where it reminds us that God heard their groaning and God remembered his covenant with Abraham, Isaac, and with Jacob. God saw the people of Israel and God knew. I think here we have one of the most important portraits of Yahweh we get in all of Scripture. We have this particular story about Moses, who's now in Midian, sort of, it looks from a narrative perspective, he's kind of putting his past behind them, but it's as if as the moment Moses puts his past behind him that Yahweh seems to remember. And we learn something about Yahweh, that Yahweh is a God who hears. Yahweh is a God who remembers. Yahweh is a God who sees. And Yahweh is a God who knows. Yahweh is a God who hears. We can imagine whatever your image or portrait of God is, it is not the distant clockmaker who cares nothing for the plights of men. Yahweh is a God who remembers. This remembering is rooted in the covenant made with Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. In other words, Yahweh remembers because he is faithful. Yahweh is a God who sees, who does not look past the reality of injustice and suffering. But most importantly, it says this, and God knew. What does that mean, God knew? Well, the Hebrew word yada here is not just about intellectual knowing, but experiential knowing. In other words, as if the story is implying, God experientially knows the reality of suffering? It's an interesting question. What do we make of a God who knows well the reality of human suffering and misery? Better yet, how does this God know intimately human misery and suffering? And so Moses, a shepherd in Midian, who has seemingly forgotten his people, there is a God who has not forgotten them. And as we approach, the chapter comes from the cosmic back to the particular, and it slows down to a crawl. Whenever we see this in a narrative in scripture, whenever it slows down the action, it's saying, pay attention, listen, this right here is important. And now Moses, being a shepherd, is providentially led to Mount Horeb, also known as Mount Sinai. What the text tells us is the mountain of God. And here Moses meets someone he did not expect. Moses has a theophany. He sees a bush in the distance. Now, a desert bush is no strange thing, but the strange thing about this one is that it's burning with fire. And it's the text tells the angel of the Lord is dwelling in this bush, and it's burnt, but it's not consumed. And this intrigues Moses. And so he approaches only to hear his name. Moses, Moses. And as he approaches, the voice speaks again. It says, take off your sandals. This is holy ground. Moses meets a God who makes the ordinary holy, who makes the seemingly everyday a part of his divine glory. And so in this moment, Moses takes off his sandals and comes face to face with the God of his ancestors. And here, Moses meets the one who will make a fugitive a redeemer. The Lord says this, I have surely seen the affliction of my people who are in Egypt. And I've heard their cry because of their taskmasters. I know their sufferings. And I have come down to deliver them out of the hand of the Egyptians and to bring them up out of that land to a good and broad land, a land flowing with milk and honey, to the place of the Canaanites, the Hittites, the Amorites, the Perizzites, the Hivites, and the Jebusites. And now, behold, the cry of the people of Israel has come to me, and I have also seen the oppression with which the Egyptians oppressed them. Come, I will send you to Pharaoh, that you may bring my people, the children of Israel, out of Egypt. Again, we learn something interesting about Yahweh. That Yahweh's divine action takes place through human partners. And this follows the pattern, if we remember back to the story of Genesis, the Imago Dei, the image of God, that humans were called to be these stewards. Literally, the word image in Hebrew is the word tselem, which is the same word used for an idol. That the humans were literally idols of Yahweh because they're his representative figures in the world. Here's what I mean by this. In the ancient world, whenever you built an idol and put it somewhere, it was meant to designate the authority of a ruler of the god who ruled there. And so humans are now in creation as God's divine, human divine partners working out his purposes in the world. And so it's funny. Yahweh says, I will redeem, but you gotta go. I will rescue, I will set the people free, but Moses, you got to get moving. And now, Moses, I don't know about you, but if I was called by God in a burning bush to go and free people, I would ask the same question, who am I? Maybe it's humility, maybe it's fear, maybe it's a lack of confidence. We can't psychoanalyze Moses, but the question still stands. Because remember, the last time Moses tried to free someone, someone said, who are you? Who do you think you are? Who made you prince and ruler over us? So it makes sense that when Yahweh is sending Moses to go so that Yahweh might free his people, Moses is like, man, who am I? I tried this before. I tried liberation before. I tried redemption before. I tried to free my people, And they asked a great question. Who am I? Who gave me authority to do such things? Moses is an exile. He's a stranger in a foreign land. He has no authority. And it's this first denial of divine calling is firmly rooted, it seems, in Moses' own internal struggle. Who is Moses to play redeemer? He's been down that road. He's tried that game, and it's led him here to exile. But then Yahweh responds in the most particular way. It's as almost as if he doesn't hear Moses' question. Moses says, who am I? And God responds, Yahweh responds, I will go with you. Moses is trying to figure out something about himself, and Yahweh in responding says, I will go with you. And while the answer doesn't seem to be related to the question, it's intimately related to the question, because Moses' identity, like the people of Israel, be firmly rooted in this God that is with them. And while he might be a stranger in a foreign land, he is no stranger to Yahweh. And so when Yahweh calls him, it's not about who Moses is. It is about who's going with him. Who made you prince and ruler over us? The question resonates again. And this time, the authority Moses lacked to free his people the first time. Well, now the authority comes from Yahweh to go and bring his people into freedom. And Yahweh, knowing Moses' frailty, says, I will give you a sign. And this is what he tells him. When you have brought the people out of Egypt, you shall serve me on this mountain. It's an odd sign. It's not immediate. We'll find out later that God gives him these other signs that are really immediate in the moment. But the sign that Moses is the one to redeem his people will be when the people are at this very mountain worshiping Yahweh. And so we have Moses, this frail fugitive, is now called by Yahweh to be a redeemer. And his only qualification for such a moment is Yahweh's presence going with him. But Moses isn't finished. He has questions. He has some real concerns. And so, in maybe a moment of projection, or maybe he's just doing his due diligence, because if any divine entity came and spoke to you and told you to go free people, you'd have more questions. Moses turns the question on Yahweh and he says, who are you? Like, if they ask me, who's sending me? Like, what name do I give? What's the government? What's your social security? How will they know that this is legit? That, imagine for a moment you're the people of Israel and someone comes to Egypt and says, hey, I'm here to free you. Who sent you? I should have asked for his name. And so Moses, maybe being a little prudent, asked for Yahweh's name. And again, Yahweh is so fascinating how he responds. I've been using this word Yahweh because it's the name that's kind of condensed to serve out this sentence. Really, what Moses gets given is not a name, but a sentence. And here's what he tells Moses. He says, what's my name? I am who I am. Or I will be who I will be. Now, if you're like me, that's not a name. That's a statement. Imagine if I met you and I said, hey, what's your name? I am who I am. I got that part. But this is the name Yahweh gives Moses. I am who I am. Or you could translate it, I will be who I will be. And it's as if one singular name cannot capture the immensity of this God. The statement, I am who I am, or I will be who I will be, speaks to an unchanging yet dynamic presence. A God who is in all and through all and yet above all. One way to read this is that when Moses asks, who are you? And Yahweh responds, I am who I am, or I will be who I will be. It's as if Yahweh is saying, I will be exactly who Israel needs me to be. And you can't name that. You can't name a God who's so transcendent and yet so particular, who's so dynamic and yet so eternal. And so Yahweh literally tells Moses, I will be who I will be. I will be whatever Israel needs me to be, but that's not going to be revealed in my words and be revealed in my actions. I will be who I will be. You just got to watch. And this is the God that is going to go with Moses to free his people. He will be who Moses needs him to be when the time comes. He will be what Israel needs him to be when the time comes. And he's not going to give them a name. He's going to give them his actions. He's going to free his people through his servant Moses. And so now Moses, the fugitive, leaves Midian a liberator. The liberator he could not be on his own. God sends him to confront Pharaoh. And Moses has other objections. He says, Lord, I stutter. And Yahweh's like, okay, cool, take your brother. He can speak well. And so this unlikely fugitive who has this deep desire for justice, who had no authority to enact it, now goes in the authority of Yahweh to speak to Pharaoh. But liberation isn't going to come easy. Moses and Aaron get before Pharaoh, and very famously, you know, let my people go, you know, stands before Pharaoh. Yahweh has come to, has told me to tell you to let my people go so they could worship me at Mount Sinai, Mount Horeb. Pharaoh listens. He says, why are you wasting my time? Who's Yahweh? Last time I checked, I'm a god myself. I've descended from Ra. I don't listen to little foreign Hebrew gods. So stop distracting the people with the thoughts of liberation. Matter of fact, tell them to get back to work. And you know what? Just for my inconvenience, tell them to make bricks without straw. If you've never made a brick before in the ancient world, makes it 10 times more difficult. And so Pharaoh does not listen and thus sets up our conflict for next week. This is the word of the Lord. As it's been custom here, we have taken some opportunity with these teachings to have answer questions. And so we'll take the next few minutes maybe to answer two or three questions and have a reflection that's going to lead us to the Lord's table together. But as we're sitting in this Moses narrative, what arises for you? What questions do you have? It's not a trick question. You can like raise your hand and ask something. Yeah. Ooh. Does Yahweh or does the God of Israel acknowledge the existence of other gods? You're kind of getting into my sermon for next week. But I will answer this is that actually what I'll argue is the chief purpose of Yahweh's liberation of the people of Israel is part of what he says is that he's going to judge the gods of Egypt. Can't judge what's not real. So interesting point. That's for next week. Don't spoil it too much, okay? Any other questions? Oh, we'll go here and then here. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
So Elohim in the Hebrew is literally just the word for gods. El is the singular of the word God, and then Elohim is the plural. The im is kind of what makes it grammatically plural. So when the Bible calls God, God, it's just, it refers to a type of being. So Yahweh is a God, right? So he is an Elohim. And so it can be used as a name, but it's not really a proper name. It'd be like if I said, if I didn't call you Luke, I said, man, that man over there, right? Like, we'll be referring to you even though that's not your name. So yeah, Elohim's not a proper name. It's a title, a type of being. Yahweh is the particular name of the God of the Hebrew people. And it comes from the statement, I am who I am. And it's the kind of, we can get into a little bit Hebrew. So Hebrew primarily works with these kind of roots. And so Yahweh is this kind of the root, we'd call letters, they're not necessarily letters, of that phrase, I am who I am. It's related to literally the phrase for like being, like I am, which is why it's very interesting when Jesus calls himself I am. In Greek, that's ego eimi. He's literally saying, I am. But this kind of reference to literally what Yahweh is saying in that name is, I am my very being. I am my own existence. We can get into a lot there. But yeah, Elohim is just a title. Didi? Yeah, I mean, when we get into it, we do a lot of assumption in reading, but we can actually just pull up the exact verse so we can read it and maybe do some translation. Throw it on the ground. Oh, he says, Moses replied to the Lord, please, Lord, I have never been eloquent, either in the past or recently, or since you have been speaking to your servant. I love that. That's so funny. He said, I haven't been good at speaking in the past, not recently. Also, in this conversation, I haven't gotten any better. But really, that's stuttering. It's something like we sort of like read into it, just saying he's not eloquent. And apparently Aaron was more eloquent. And so you kind of get this relationship where Moses becomes like a stand-in for Yahweh. And then Aaron becomes like his prophet, which kind of mimics the relationship between Yahweh and Moses. Yahweh is God and then Moses is his prophet. But yeah, it's just, it says he's not eloquent, whatever that means. Okay, let's get one and then two and then we'll bring this thing to a close. Yeah. 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 Yeah, sure. That's a two big questions. One, I'll answer the first one. Yeah, so question one was why do we use the plural rather than El? And both get used for God throughout the Old Testament. I think early Christian interpreters, the church fathers, would read back into the Old Testament that this is a sign of the Trinity. And I don't think that's necessarily wrong. I think also, too, there is a kind of wordplay that happens in the Old Testament, in the Hebrew scriptures, where you put plurals on things to talk about their immensity. So the word for sky, shamayim, is like the skies. There's one sky, but the immensity of something like the sky, you use the plural. So there might be something there too. It's just literally like a way to grammatically talk about something's immensity. The second question, maybe I'll save that for the podcast. So just so we can get this last question. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, that's a great question. I think that was definitely creative license. but actually, chapter 2, verse 23 gives us a little clue. He says, after a long time, the king of Egypt died. So we don't know Moses' relationship to the Pharaoh. If, you know, again, we that movie makes a lot of what it meant for Moses to be like a prince of Egypt. He could have just been a novelty in the royal court. Again, that's why I think the Hebrew slaves' words to him are so important. He kind of didn't have any real authority. And so while he might have been the adopted son of the princess, like, fetishizing foreign people is not something new in the world. And so he could have just been like, ooh, that's our like token Hebrew in the royal court. Like, very seriously. So we don't really know the extent in which. We also know that he's not, again, like, he's not initially like received well at all, you know? He gets kind of in trouble for like riling up the people because they think they're going to be free. Yeah, that's a good question. Prince of Egypt is a great movie, though. Yeah, let's end there.